Job chapters 28 and 29, lengthy text, so we're just going to jump right into it. I have two basic points I would like to make, but first I'd like to share with you a statement, if you'll allow it, from a novel I read a couple of months ago. It was a phenomenal book. If you like historical fiction, you would very much like this. It's the name of the novel is Byzantium, and it's by a guy named Stephen Lawhead. And I actually bought a copy for a guy in our church shortly after reading it, who was kind of laid up, and his wife stole it from him and read it and said it was one of the best things she'd ever read. I don't think he's even opened it. But it's a phenomenal book if you like historical fiction. And it's set just before the end of the first millennium. It's set in the 900s AD, and it's about a band of Vikings who abduct a young Irish monk named Aidan. And it's some powerful passages in it in which Aidan presents what Christianity is to these Vikings. It's extremely well done. Just a number of sections that I highlighted that I thought were just fantastic, in which a Christian tries to explain to utterly pagan pagans what Christianity is, and their reactions as Vikings trying to understand, men who believed in Thor and Odin, trying to understand who Jesus is. And at the end of the novel, as the novel goes on, I'm not giving away any great spoilers here, but the young monk goes through, it's a long, long book, but he goes through a great number of trials and difficulties, and he begins to lose his faith. At the end of the novel, he's having a conversation with his confessor about the loss of his faith, and the reason he is losing his faith is because of the suffering that he endured. I thought about Job, and I liked what his confessor said to him. I thought I would just share a little bit of this conversation with you between Aidan and his confessor. Aidan, the monk, says this. He says, "I thought I could depend on the truth, but I have learned there is no truth. The innocent are everywhere slaughtered. They die pleading for God to save them, and death takes them anyway. Faith's own guardians are inconstant liars, and Christ's holy church is a nest of vipers. The emperor, God's co-ruler on earth, is a vile, unholy murderer. Life is a school of the spirit, Aidan," his confessor answered. "Learning is our soul's requirement, and suffering is our most persuasive teacher." "Oh, aye, it is a school," Aidan said. "It is a terrible school wherein we learn harsh and bitter lessons. We begin by trusting and learn that there is no one worthy of our trust. We learn that we are all alone in this world and our cries go unheeded." Think about Job and all that he has said so far. "We learn that death is the only certainty. Yes, we all die, most in agony and torment, some in misery, and the fortunate few in peace, but we all die. Death is God's one answer to all our prayers." To which his confessor says, "Do not blaspheme, Aidan." "Blaspheme," he challenged. "Why, I speak the very heart of God's own truth, brother. How is that blasphemy? We put our trust in the Lord God and were proved fools for believing. We endured slavery and torture and death, and God lifted not a finger to save us. I saw our own blessed bishop hacked to pieces before my eyes, and God, the God he loved and served all his days, did not so much as lift a finger to ease his suffering." And then this statement by his confessor. "As he did nothing when his beloved son died on the cross," he pointed out, "we are closest to Christ when sharing the world's misery. Think you Jesus came to remove our pains? Wherever did you get that notion? The Lord came not to remove our suffering, but to show us the way through it to the glory beyond. We can overcome our travails. That is the promise of the cross." Thought about that little scene in looking at Job 29 and 30. I think that's very well said. Beautiful conversation. By the way, the book ends on a very positive and a very encouraging note. Stephen Lawhead is a Christian who wrote it. And I thought that was a great discussion about suffering. It does feel like in the midst of suffering that God doesn't hear us. or that if he does hear us, he is indifferent to our cries. Probably most Baptist Christians and Christians of whatever denomination would admit that they have had moments where they wondered where God was. And by the way, one of the things I have learned as a pastor is that if you can ever have prolonged conversation with a Baptist Christian away from other Baptists, they will finally become honest and tell you what they really struggle with. And routinely, it is this question: why does God feel so distant when I need him to feel near, to be near? I have heard people say that were, not even speaking about here, but just over the years, I have heard people say that on the outside had it all together, right? You look at certain people and you think, that person never doubts. Part of the human condition in suffering is to question and struggle. There is no shame in that. I will remind you that the Lord Jesus in Gethsemane is a pretty good thing for us to ponder, that he'd sweat drops of blood and ask that there might be another way. But even then, he trusted the will of the Father. In Job 28 and 29, we find a pretty fascinating continuing statement from Job. And this is Job, please forgive me, it's 29 and 30. I apologize. The first point I want to make is this: Job bemoans the loss of his life before the tragedy when he walked in righteousness and God blessed him deeply. I'm just going to read 29 in its entirety. It's not overly long. It's 20 verses, but remember, most of these verses are little couplets. They're just two statements. But 29, we're in the midst of a prolonged multi-chapter statement. This is the longest statement by Job. Normally it's Job in one or two chapters that his friends reply. This has been going for some chapters now. And in chapter 29 of Job, Job simply regrets everything he's lost. I mean, this is a statement of a man who realizes what he's lost. Just listen to this. And I would encourage you to read, of course, but if not, you might just even shut your eyes or whatever. Just really listen to what Job says. I'm just going to read it. And Job again took up his discourse and said, "Oh, that I were as in the months of old, as in the days when God watched over me, when his lamp shone upon my head, and by his light I walked through darkness, as I was in my prime." By the way, you ever said that? "Oh, that life could be like it was in my prime. When the friendship of God was upon my tent, when the Almighty was yet with me, when my children were all around me, when my steps were washed with butter, and the rock poured out for me streams of oil. When I went out to the gate of the city, when I prepared my seat in the square, the young men saw me and withdrew." That was a statement of the veneration of Job. Young people stepped back from him. He was respected, esteemed. "And the aged rose and stood. The princes refrained from talking and laid their hand on their mouth. The voice of the nobles was hushed, and their tongue stuck to the roof of their mouth. When the ear heard, it called me blessed, and when the eye saw, it approved. Because I delivered the poor who cried for help, and the fatherless who had none to help him. The blessing of him who was about to perish came upon me, and I caused the widow's heart to sing for joy. I put on righteousness, and it clothed me. My justice was like a robe and a turban. I was eyes to the blind and feet to the lame. I was a father to the needy, and I searched out the case of him whom I did not know. I broke the fangs of the unrighteous and made him drop his prey from his teeth. Then I thought, I shall die in my nest, and I shall multiply my days as the sand. My roots spread out to the waters with the dew all night on my branches, my glory fresh with me, and my bow ever new in my hand." What an amazing picture of unrestrained nostalgia. Nostalgia is a powerful thing, isn't it? I've noticed this also in churches. It's not uniform, it's an unfair generalization, but even in the life of churches, each generation is nostalgic for a particular period. And usually that's around a pastor that you just really liked, or another minister. This is why if you listen to people, if you stood up into this church and went to different age groups, when was the golden age in this church? You would get 10 different answers. Because for the youth and the youth group right now, this is it. But for some of you, it was 20 years ago. For some of you, it was the day before I was hired. But everyone's got a golden age in the life of the church. And I've noticed, and that's okay. I'm not even beating up on that. I'm just saying it's human. The only problem is if you impose your golden age on everyone else. Please understand that lots of people, as new people come into a church, this is their great moment. Now, give them 30 years, they may be nostalgic or whatever, but then new people will be whatever. If you can break free of that, by the way, and see the beauty of every moment, it's a liberating thing. There's beautiful things happening and frustrating things happening in every age of the life of the church. And by and large, it's as beautiful as you choose to see it, right? I mean, God's always at work in the life of his church. That's a little side lesson. That's 50 cents. Y'all can pay me afterwards for that. Otherwise, it's free. But nostalgia. I mean, to think back. The beautiful thing about nostalgia is it reminds us of a time that was blissful. The bad thing about it is that we all over-romanticize the past. We all do. Can I remind you that the past is not as great as you thought it was? Everyone complains in the moment, and then afterwards, like, well, that was, I mean, man. Listen to how people describe their child. When I was a child, it was like a Norman Rockwell painting, and no one was ever sick, and no one ever had problems, no one ever got divorced, and everyone just ran around with great big turkey legs on bicycles, just eating turkey legs, and no one ever gained weight, and it was phenomenal, and all the marriages were perfect, and everyone was happy, and we didn't need air conditioning because we didn't get hot. God didn't make us with pores back then. We were all just internally cooled up. It wasn't like that. It wasn't like that. Albeit, maybe some things were better, maybe some things were not. But you know what Job is doing here actually is more than nostalgia. It's actually a man who is legitimately bemoaning the loss, I think not even of his name. He's bemoaning the loss of a period of time in which he and God walked in peace together. This is real. For Job, according to the beginning of the book of Job, this really was what it was like. Job was a righteous man. He was a good man. I'm not sure exactly what he means when he says his roads were like butter. It sounds profoundly high in cholesterol, but probably that's a very good thing for Job. Oil and butter, it was a good time. And he says near the end of chapter 29, I thought I would die in my nest. Let's be honest, we all want to die in our nest. We really do. We'd all like to die in a bed in which someone just put on nice, clean sheets, surrounded by our family, everyone who looks perfect and no one who has any problems with each other, and everyone's smiling and singing very softly, whatever, Amazing Grace, and we just die peacefully. That's not real. Sometimes it is. Sometimes it is. I've seen that. But life has a way of being oftentimes more brutal than we think, doesn't it? It sneaks up behind us. It catches us unaware. I just want to be sympathetic with Job, to be honest. I'm not judging Job. Again, every now and then you read commentators who beat up on Job, but he buried 10 children. He mentions his children. I thought I'd be surrounded by my children, and I'm not. I remember pastoring a church once, and a very sweet elderly lady walked into the office, and she was in tears, and I remember asking her, why are you in tears? And she said, because everything's changed. Nothing is like it was. My family's gone. My friend's gone. The town has changed. Nothing's like it was. It's not the town I remember as a little girl. Everything's different. And she just cried. And you desperately want to be sympathetic, but there's a time to look at each other and say, that's called life. That's called life. Job's life took a turn he did not expect. In order, this is what he misses. His close relationship with God, verses 1 through 5. He misses his family, the second part of verse 5. He misses the name that he had among people. It's a classic big fish in a little pond, then little fish in a big pond. Except for Job, it's a much more dire situation. But you remember when it was your glory day? Did you ever have a glory day when you were the man? You look back. This is why in seminary they tell you never pastor a church in which the former pastor is now a member. I'll let y'all think about why that might be. I'm not saying that's true. By the way, not just saying this. I've got a good buddy pastoring a church where the former pastor is the pastor and he's his best friend. I think that's an unfair generalization. But there are times when it's hard not to try to relive the glory days. It's hard to let go. It's hard for all of us. And this is why I tell Mrs. Richardson, please, if I survive the ministry, do not let me be that guy where they're all having meetings saying, we like this old fellow, but how do we get him to retire? Jim Holly, just come up and say to me, it's time. Just say, when the horse is dead, dismount, Richardson. It's over. Just give me a cake. Say goodbye. That'll be it. But it's a sad thing. I mean, he thinks about, there was a time when young people withdrew respectfully and the wise men put their hands over. There was a time when Job was the man. I mean, he really was the man. And now, look at what has happened to Job. Next, he bemoans the loss of his ministry to the poor and the downtrodden. This isn't bragging. If Job 1 and 2 did not exist, we would think this was bragging. Job 1 tells us he was righteous. Job did this image that he snatched the prey from the mouth of the attacker. Beautiful. Job, he says he was eyes to the blind, feet to the lame. He was the man who cared for people who needed care. Next, what he misses, he misses opposing those who oppress the downtrodden. He stood up to bullies. If you look at verse 17, if someone was preying on a weaker person, I see this phrase everywhere now in the news, punching down. Punching down means beating up on someone who's weaker than you, punching down. Job didn't like for people to punch down. He took care of people. He watched people. He protected them. And lastly, his sense of optimism and hope about the future, dying in his nest. Chapter 29, Job misses this. He has lost this. We can almost hear the same kind of statement in Psalm 51 when the psalmist says, purge me with hyssop and I shall be clean. Wash me and I shall be whiter than snow. Let me hear joy and gladness. Let the bones that you have broken rejoice. Hide your face from my sins and blot out all my iniquities. Create in me a clean heart, O God. Renew a right spirit within me. Cast me not away from your presence. Take not your Holy Spirit from me. Restore to me the joy of your salvation. And uphold me with a willing spirit. Let me just say to any of you who are in a Job 29 moment, maybe you're in a Job 29 decade. Maybe it's been a rough 10 years. And your God has not abandoned you. And I don't say that to minimize what is in the life of this church, for many of you, just very real pain. That's not my point. But my point is, please don't think your God has abandoned you. He has not. He loves you very, very much. Everyone has walked through Job 29. Did any of you ever see, I don't know, in this crowd we might not have, but probably some of you, did any of y'all see Napoleon Dynamite? A couple of you are grinning. It's a funny movie. It's gloriously weird. My wife hates that movie. I find it phenomenal. That is frequently the case in our house. And if that is the case, you should probably agree with Ronnie. But Napoleon's this weird kid, basically, and he's got this uncle. Remember Uncle Rico? What is Uncle Rico obsessed with? Someone tell me. What is it he's always reliving? What? Yeah, his old football days in high school. He's what, mid-30s in that movie, whatever? He's saying, we could have won state. I bet you I could throw this football over that mountain, he says. He's just completely delusional about the past. That's what can happen if you get stuck there. Let me say something to those of you who are just kind of stuck in a nostalgic moment. I'm not talking about actual loss. There needs to be a differentiation between people who are just greatly suffering in their soul and people who are just stuck in a moment. The past is over. You have people in this church and in your life and in your family and in your sphere of influence and at your job, whatever sphere you're nostalgic in, who need you to be here. Every moment you sit around and think, man, I miss 1980. 1980's gone. But there are flesh and blood, youth and kids and senior adults and middle-aged people and lost people who need to know Jesus and people who've just been saved who need to grow in Jesus and people who've been saved for so long they need to rediscover Jesus. You know what I'm talking about? Who needs you here. Please don't just get stuck back there. It wasn't as great as you remember it. If you could go back there, you'd be listening to people who missed 1970. Right? It just goes on and on. It's time. Be in the moment now. And then Job 30. Job bemoans the loss of his name and the respect that it once brought. We have a lengthier statement about his name. It's actually the last few verses of Job 29 and then chapter 30. Job 29, 21, men listened to me and waited and kept silence for my counsel. It's a sign of respect. I'll tell you something else they say in seminary. One of these days I'm going to preach a sermon called Things They Say in Seminary That You're Not Supposed to Tell Your Congregation They Say in Seminary. And one of them is that every church that you pastor has subterranean pastors. Subterranean pastors are powerful lay people who actually are leaders, who are actually leading the church. And let me say very quickly, that's not necessarily a bad thing. It's actually a good thing. Because pastors come and then pastors go. Subterranean pastors, I mean, you can have good ones or bad ones. Bad ones are guys who are just working behind the scenes to do bad things. But good subterranean pastors, they're lay leaders who people look to. But Job says, men listened to me and waited and kept silence. When I was in seminary, I remember a professor said, if you want to identify who the subterranean pastors in your church are, watch the eyes of the people in your church when they are faced with a major decision in a business meeting. The man or woman they look towards, that's him or her. Do y'all know what I'm talking about? Someone who's been in a church for a long time, and again, it's neither good nor bad. It's the person. Now, after a while, 5, 6, 10 years, usually takes about 5 years before a pastor can actually start pastoring. First couple years, a lot of people are like, we like you, but you're new. You know what I mean? You have to kind of, and that's understandable, because a lot of pastors are rascals. I actually dislike most pastors. I'm not a big fond of my peers, which is why I don't have a lot of pastor friends, other than my brothers and a couple of other guys. I dislike them half the time, and they dislike me. But that's okay. But people that are looked to for wisdom, that's a good thing. It gives a church continuity. This church has been blessed with men and women who give the church continuity. These are the people who keep the church moving forward in between pastors. These are the people who keep the church from folding in under a bad pastor. These are the people who help it make decisions. That's a good thing. Job was that guy. Job was the subterranean pastor. He was the leader, and people looked to him, and he said, men listened to me and waited and kept silence for my counsel. I'll tell you a great way to have a short ministry: oppose your subterranean pastors. Go into a new church and don't listen to respected people. You'll quickly be finding a new church. And usually people who are insecure do that. But learn to appreciate that God's given people gifts, and God has given churches the gift of wise people who have been there a very long time, who understand how things work. That's a blessing. Job was that guy. After I spoke, they did not speak again. Now that can be a problem. But what Job is saying, Job carried the room. You ever seen anyone carry the room? In the midst of a big heated conversation, someone stands up and they speak and people follow. Ronnie and I witnessed this, I won't belabor the point, but in St. Louis a few months ago, Southern Baptist Convention, 7,000 people arguing about an issue, and one man stood up, and I looked at Ronnie and said, he just carried the entire room. It was over. It was one of the most compelling, persuasive, powerful, beautiful, wise statements, and you could feel it in the room. You ever experienced this? When one person, man or woman, stands up and you sit there and think, that's it. That's it. They carried the room. Job carried the room. They waited for me as for the rain. Well, he said, after I spoke, they did not speak again, and my word dropped upon them. They waited for me as for the rain, and they opened their mouths as for the spring rain. That may be a little hyperbole, got to be honest, but you know, the point is, Job was wise. I smiled on them when they had no confidence, and the light of my face they did not cast down. I chose their way and sat as chief, and I lived like a king among his troops, like one who comforts mourners. Then Job 30, we'll just move through this quickly. But now, what? Verse 1, Job 30. But now they laugh at me. Watch the fall of Job. Men who are younger than I, whose fathers I would have disdained to set with the dogs of my flock. What could I gain from the strength of their hands, men whose vigor is gone? This is bad. Job saying, even the kids of the guys I consider to be sorry are now laughing at me. How the mighty have fallen. I used to be the man. I used to be the subterranean pastor. People looked to me. When I spoke, it was over. I carried the room. And now the sorry sons of the sorry men whom I used to know laugh at me and mock me. Through want and hard hunger, they gnaw the dry ground by night in waste and desolation. They pick salt wort and the leaves of bushes and the roots of the broom tree for their food. He's describing these guys. They are driven out from human company. They shout after them as after a thief. In the gullies of the torrents, they must dwell in holes of the earth and of the rocks. These guys who are laughing at Job, what he's saying is these guys are sorry. And they're laughing at me. You can tell a lot about a guy by the quality of his detractors. He's saying my detractors are of low quality. Even the men who mock me are men that I barely consider men. Among the bushes they bray, under the nettles they huddle together, a senseless, a nameless brood they have whipped out of the land, that they have been whipped out of the land, and now I have become their song. I am a byword to them. These dudes, they abhor me. They keep aloof from me. They do not hesitate to spit at the sight of me. Watch. Because God has loosed my cord and humbled me, they have cast off restraint in my presence. When Job was powerful, they restrained themselves. There are men and women who, when they are on the top of their game, people know better than to mess with them. You know what I'm talking about? Powerful people, people who have it together, people who are esteemed. Now, I'm not talking about even manipulative people or people who earned it by some sort of caprice. I mean, just strong people. And Job is saying, man, they have no restraint now. They're kicking me while I'm down. On my right hand, verse 12, the rabble rise. They push away my feet. They cast up against me their ways of destruction. They break up my path. They promote my calamity. They need no one to help them. As through a wide breach they come, amid the crash they roll on. Reminds us of Tennyson, the light, charge of the light brigade? Oh, half a league, half a league, half a league onward into the valley of death rode the 600. It's a great picture. It's this the battle of this, about the Crimean War, I think, and this picture of like an opposing force pouring through a breach in the wall. Verse 15, terrors are upon me, my honor is pursued as by wind, and my prosperity has passed away like a cloud. So Job is broken. Job is broken. We see in verse 29 the height of Job's glory. And we see in Job 30, the first part, the depths of Job's despair. And then lastly, we see this. Job bemoans the loss of his relationship with God as he knew it. Look at verse 16. And now my soul is poured out within me. Days of affliction have taken hold of me. The night racks my bones, and the pain that gnaws me takes no rest. With great force my garment is disfigured. It binds me about like the collar of my tunic. Watch verse 19. God has cast me into the mire. Who does Job blame here? He's done it before. God. He blames God. And I have become like dust and ashes. I cry to you. Now he turns his words to God. I cry to you for help and you do not answer me. I stand and you only look at me. You have turned cruel to me. Now, let me interject something we've interjected all along. Again, God will say at the end of Job that Job was right in what he said about God. But I repeat, that simply means that Job was right in his primary statement, not that he was right in everything he said. God was not being cruel to Job. In other words, you can say the gist of what Job said he got right, he did get right, in pushing against what his friends were saying, that Job had some hidden sin and this was punishment. It's not punishment. But from Job's perspective, it was cruel. You have turned cruel to me. With the might of your hand, you persecute me. So he says, God, you're being cruel to me. God, you're persecuting me. You lift me up on the wind. You make me ride on it, and you toss me about in the roar of the storm. For I know that you will bring me to death and to the house appointed for all living. Yet does not one in a heap of ruins stretch out his hand and in his disaster cry for help? Again, in the midst of his complaint about God, Job realizes that his only possible help is in God. You see this? We've talked before about Job's almost kind of schizophrenic nature. And let me say, I don't even mean that as a criticism. I think when people are deeply hurting, they oftentimes vacillate between these two extremes. On the one hand, they feel an anger towards God, but even in the midst of their anger, they know that their only hope is in God. And let me just say this to all of you. I don't know, you may not like this. It may make you mad at me. But if you're there, that's okay. Don't beat yourself up for those moments when you question. I'll remind you that of everything God said to Job, and Job did learn to put his hand over his mouth, but God doesn't beat him up for being a human being. Nowhere in Job does God beat Job up for being a human being with questions, ever. Now, he does reach a point where he says, okay, enough. You've got to trust in me. But don't let the fact that you're a Baptist and we kind of grow up feeling guilt over every single thing. Sometimes our guilt is deserved. Sometimes it's from the devil. You know, human beings who are suffering, they oftentimes ask questions. And I think God no more rejects our questions than you reject the questions of your children. Yeah, I mean, when your children were little and came up, why did you do this? You didn't just smack them down. If you did, you were like a really bad parent. Most of us try to show some patience, understanding. And we think, you know, that my little child can't see and understand everything. It's okay. Yet does not one in a heap of ruins stretch out his hand and in his disaster cry for help? Did not I weep for him whose day was hard? Was not my soul grieved for the needy? Interesting. Watch the flow of Job's argument. Chapter 29, I helped people when they were hurting. Chapter 30, God, I'm hurting. Job would like for God to extend to him the charity
that he extended to others. It's reasonable. God, would you help me? But when I hoped for good, evil came. When I waited for light, darkness came. My inward parts are in turmoil and never still. You ever been through something and felt like your insides were just roiling like a storm? One of the things that I think I will probably end up regretting at the end of my ministry, unless we can start getting this right now, is encouraging transparency in church. There really is something about church life that encourages plasticity. We're all plastic with each other. I'm always warning us not to be, but we just are. Like, we feel like we got to go to church, put on the mask. You know what I'm talking about? I mean, do you feel the freedom to just tell people what's really going on? You really should. I mean, church should be the place where we're real with each other. I just want to tell you it's okay to be real. Really. I think God is no more impressed with our religious shows and putting on airs. Church ought to be a place where hurting people can come and be open with what they're hurting with and be encouraged. You know what I mean? It's okay to be real. I've never wanted to be one of those preachers who's not real. I don't know. I actually have a fairly low opinion of myself, believe it or not. I've told Mrs. Richardson I'm a strange, weird mix of ego and self-loathing. I suspect maybe most people are. We all think we're great in some ways, and yet we all know we're pretty terrible in other ways. And it's okay to say that. I was in a preaching class in seminary, and the professor said, when you preach, never use the pronoun we or us. Always say you. I knew at the time that was nonsense. Give me a break. In other words, create distance. Don't be overly transparent. And for the record, I do think preachers can be overly transparent. The pulpit isn't your psychiatrist's couch where you sit down and just vomit everything over poor, unsuspecting people who really need you to lead them. But it also doesn't need to be like a plastic barrier where you put on airs and act like you're Billy Graham or something. Most of us are just sinners in need of grace. You know what I mean? Most of us aren't as bad as our critics say, and we're not as good as our mamas think we are. Most of us are just human beings. That's okay. It's okay to be a mess. God loves messes. Okay? Let's conclude. We'll go home. But when I hoped for good, evil came, and when I waited for light, darkness came. My inward parts are in turmoil and never still. Days of affliction come to meet me. I go about darkened, but not by the sun. What a sentence. I stand up in the assembly now and cry for help. See the distinction? I used to stand up and everyone else sat down. Now everyone else is standing up and I'm crying in a heap. As I stand up, I cry for help. I am a brother of jackals and a companion of ostriches. That's not a compliment. By the way, you ever been chased by an ostrich? I was once. Horrifying. Horrifying. It's another story by another day. I was on the back of a pickup truck. One of the worst moments of my life. You do not want your brother to be an ostrich. My skin turns black and falls from me. My bones burn with heat. That's what it felt like in Long Island. My lyre is turned to mourning and my pipe to the voice of those who weep. Look, if you're here, if you look at your life and it seems like the rise and fall of you. That's how a lot of lives work out. I mean, ask yourself this honestly. Terrible question, but ask yourself, when did you peak? When was your great moment? Most people, either at work or most people have a moment. This was my great moment. Mine was in ninth grade when I scored a touchdown against Heathwood Hall. Only one I ever scored. It's all been downhill since then with the exception of Mrs. Richardson. Save. Just picking. When'd you peak? Hey, if your peak is Christ, then you are always peaked. It's when we get lost in our own heads and hearts that we see the great fall. You have a God, listen, you have a God who loves you as much right now as you could possibly be loved. And he doesn't see you as having peaked. God does not say to you what the devil says to you. Boy, sure was better back then. Boy, why are things so bad? God looks at you right now, 2016, July 27th, Wednesday night. God looks at you right now and says, that person is the special object of my affection and I love him or her. This is your peak. Now you may not feel that and things may be going terribly wrong, but my point is God has not abandoned you. He loves you that much right now. It's not over. It's not over. While you have breath and you have Christ, you have life. And when you have Christ and no longer have breath, you still have life. Christ is our peak. Amen? Let's pray. Yeah. Yes, sir, Mr. Tipp.